On this episode of Interview in Indies, we talked to Renee from Bip and Bits and cover their whole history of making games from Game Jams to Dome Keeper to their upcoming game, PVKK. If you want to support the show and get the episodes a few days early, you can subscribe to us on Patreon. And of course, enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Interview in Indies episode 12. Today, I'm joined by Renee from Bip and Bits.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Thanks for taking the time, Renee. It's always a pleasure to have indie developers on the show, especially ones that are part of some of my favorite games, which we will get into. Mm-hmm. But my first question that I always love to ask is, what really got you into game development? What's your story?
For me, it was never really a question and not a really inciting moment. I've always been gaming, like, and fascinated by games since I was a small kid, and we got our like first Nintendo Entertainment System and later first PC. And in my teens, I discovered you can program and you can actually potentially make games yourself. Like, as a kid, when you grow up, you don't have a concept of that, right?
You know, and then someone, you're just like, oh my god, games. I can make one of these things.
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically when I started, when I was 14 years old and I got my first PC. Before that, I was limited to 1 hour on the PC that I, of course, spent gaming. But after that, I was allowed more time, and I used some of that time at least to try to learn to make games. And then it only took 20 years until I released something.
20. So you were only allowed 1 hour a day on the PC, because growing up for me, I was also only allowed like 30 minutes on like an Xbox, because my parents were also like, no, too many games will ruin your brain. That's interesting. What, any of your favorite games that you played growing up?
Oh, yeah. I definitely had a lot of favorites. I know like one game that I was particularly excited about and hyped to no end was Black and White. The very first one. And I know, like, I ordered it. One of the few games I think I bought full price, because I didn't have a kid. Didn't have a lot of money to buy full price games. I usually bought, like, old cheap ones on eBay if I could.
Oh, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. So I was working a little as a kid, carrying, like, giving prospects, advertisement prospects. Mark, bringing them to people's houses and getting like $50 a month for that.
And then back then, that was still only buying like one full priced game, because games were still expensive.
Yeah. That changed things for the better for me. But then it was like, okay, you can do that 2 months and get one game, because games back then were 90 in the currency back then. I think they were like 90. Or I can get 10 older used ones.
Yeah, 10 cheap games or one really new and expensive game.
Yeah. So definitely Black and White was a mind-blowing game.
Yeah, back then. And obviously there's a lot that's happened between then and now. But one of the, I guess, more fun things is you and your wife, you're both full-time indie developers now. But you and your wife, you guys have been doing Bip and Bits for years now. What are some advantages and, I guess, disadvantages that there are for you working with your partner on projects?
Yeah. For me, it's mostly advantages. There are some disadvantages, but then I'll start with that one because it's very easy. The disadvantages, for example, if you have an event going on, Gamescom, you both want to go there.
Naturally.
And for example, as in our case, we have a kid. No one can stay home and take care of the kids. What do you do? So you have to find someone. And other people in the company, they can go to that. Some don't have kids, of course, but those who have kids can usually ask their partner to, hey, can I take four days, 3 days away? Is that all right with you? But we can't. So that feels like the only real disadvantage. The advantages are plentiful. So for one, you spend more time with each other. And if you like each other, that's nice. And you can also talk a lot about the thing you do. And if the thing you do is something you really enjoy, it's also not a bad thing to talk about that, for example, in the evening. Usually you would want to cut this, right? And have the evening private life, something like that. But you don't need that. But yeah, also with a partner, you can be, I feel like you can be more direct and more honest because you have more of a deeper trusting relationship, and you can also easily make up for misbehaving, kind of. Misbehaving is maybe not the right word, like overstepping a little bit.
Yeah.
Being too direct, you can more easily fix that with a partner because you already are used to that process.
Yeah, you already do everything ideally. Else with them, you know, the work yeah. life. So when you guys have to go to conventions, I know Bip and Bits has gone to a few. Do you guys like take turns yeah. going, or is it always just one person gets to go?
Usually, like for us, it's a little bit easier because if it's not a German speaking thing, Anna doesn't really want to go. So half of them, easily more than half of them, I go alone. But for the German things, we always have to figure out to do. And usually we leave our kid with my parents, if that works out. Right now that works. But the kid has to have a certain age until you can do that.
Yeah, until you can like leave them to the house yeah. and, you know, once they grow yeah. up. So I guess I can ask this. When did you guys start doing indie game development full time? Because I'm sure not anybody can just get into full time indie game development.
Yeah, I mean, nope. To do it full time, you need money in a way.
Yeah.
And we got ours in January 2022, after we signed with a publisher for our first game, basically back then prototype, Domekeeper. And Raw Fury, our publisher, liked it and wanted to publish and fund the project. And that was our life-changing transition to becoming full-time devs.
Oh, so Domekeeper's the game that pushed you guys over the edge to become yeah. full-time. Oh, that is awesome to hear yeah. because I know you guys do have a kind of a rich history with a lot of game jams and games on itch.io. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask this, because I've looked at your itch.io page and you've made 19 games on there.
Yeah.
And do you participate in every Ludum Dare game jam, if I'm saying that right?
Yeah, we try because we enjoy it. It's really fun, and it's also the game jams, especially Ludum Dare, like 18 out of that 19 were Ludum Dare projects. And one Game Maker Toolkit, that really shaped how we approach projects also in the company and how we run the company, basically. So, except for when our daughter was born and for when I started a new full-time job back before we were full-time devs, those were the only two Ludum Dares we missed in the whole period since we started doing them in 2017.
God dang it. Are there any projects from the Ludum Dares? Obviously, Domekeeper is probably the biggest one, because I imagine that was part of one of them. But are there any other projects that you want to make into a full game like Domekeeper?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of them. I think with counting Domekeeper, it would be four? Four, I'm not even sure, like four or five games we will eventually make, I expect.
You got a lot of plans then right there. You got a lot of games being made.
Yeah, but also the thing is, while making a game full-time, we also participate in Ludum Dare again. And then sometimes a new game gets into this list of, hey, this one we want to make full-time eventually.
So the list never ends because these Ludum... No. I guess... For people that maybe don't know, is there any difference between a Ludum Dare game jam and a typical game jam? Or is it just your average run of the mill?
Not really. It's I think it's, in a way, a typical game jam. So you get a theme, then you have 3 days to make a game from scratch, basically. In the jam mode, you can take some things in, like a little bit of a code base. But I think, I'm not sure if you can also do that in the other game mode. Like, they have two modes, compo and jam. Not really important. And then eventually you submit your game, you play the games from other people, you get feedback on your game, then hopefully you learn something.
yeah, because I imagine Domekeeper has been your most successful game jam, right? What made you want to focus on Domekeeper and make it into a full-fledged yeah. project from a game jam?
Domekeeper back then was our most successful game jam by then, definitely. But since then, I think we have a few games, at least two, on itch who did better than Dom, that we are also working on, and which will get full releases. But back then, so Dom was our 10th game jam, and we did notice immediately that there was something different about it. So we had 9 games, then we made the 10th, and I noticed like the comments from the players are a different category of hyped about this one, and a different category of how happy and excited are they about to play this game? How much are they asking for getting more of this? Also, how much time they are spending in this. Like we always try to make the game for like a 10-minute experience in the game jam, and people play that one for 1 hour or for 2 hours sometimes. So we noticed there was something different about it, just from the feedback, but also how many people played. Like usually we had to rate other games to get feedback too, and then we would end up with 40 ratings, something like that. And Dome back then got like 270 ratings.
Oh,
Just
man.
feels what feels like people were naturally flocking towards it. I posted a screenshot of it and people started playing. So there were a lot of indicators that this was something special compared to what we made before, like an outlier, a positive outlier. So we dropped the project we were working on at that time and switched over to Dome completely. I think that was a good call.
Yeah, I think that was definitely a good call because it's an incredible game and it got picked up by a publisher, I feel like immediately. How long after the game jam did it take to find your publisher?
That was actually really quick. The first publisher reached out after like 2 months, I think, so r very early. And Raw Fury was, we signed with Raw Fury half a year after the game jam. So we worked a few months on that in our spare time, with the goal of releasing a demo for Steam Next Fest. And we had a big playtest with our like 20 or 30, 40 people community, Discord community. And those people were a great help to get basically the game up to shape and fun. Some people from that time are still around, like our dear community members, Simni, the Dome Dwarf. Like these are like the guys who are still around and active in our community. Yeah, it feels very special in a way to have them around for.
Yeah, people sticking around for so long, seeing Domekeeper evolve from a little itch.io game from a game jam to, I'd say, one of like the more well-known roguelites out there that a lot of people can just easily put in 100 hours in. I guess I could ask, what do you think was one of the biggest reasons for Domekeeper's success on Steam after the game jam, minus, of course, it being an incredible game? What helped bring in more players, you think?
So I think you can approach this question from different angles, like what helped in the development and what helped with what the game is, basically. I feel like you asked for the second one. So for me, the success of Dome comes down to few things. One being that it's immediately clear what it is. Like you look at it and you from 2 seconds of gameplay, video capture, you basically understand what the game is. And that's very helpful for in our age for people to make a decision if they shall be excited about it. Then the style is also, it's not super sophisticated, but it's a little bit inviting that people can stay. Oh, I like that color scheme, I like that pixel art. That can help a little bit. But what's also really important that it's very accessible. So you can just pick it up. You don't have to do a big tutorial. You can very easily get into it. And it also has a quality that I value, and I wish ha I had more games to play myself that allow for second screen content. For example, I want to play a game. I'm playing it and I'm listening to, for example, your podcast on my second screen. And I can hear what other developers tell. And there are not that many games around. Recently, I played Thronefall, which is also very suits that style very well, to have this sort of nice flow of information, a little bit entertainment, a little bit information.
Yeah, Dome Keeper. It's a perfect game for that. I agree with you. It's so easy to just lay back, relax after a long day, do a few runs of Dome Keeper, have like, hopefully not the news on, but hopefully just like a Twitch stream or YouTube video that you like, and just relax for a bit. I guess I could also ask what helped with the development, because you said there was two sides to that question. What's the answer on the other side?
Yeah. That's for sure. One thing to the other part, though, the game's also fun.
The game is incredible.
It needs to be satisfying. And if it wouldn't be fun, then that's kind of a given, but it's also not really. And in terms of development, what helped us make a good game, I already alluded to that. We basically had a fully fleshed out experience on day three of development. So we released after 3 days in the Game Jam game, and then we got feedback on the game, and we never broke the game, really. You could always play it. And we always played it with our community, and we got a lot of great feedback, and we listened closely. And then you also have to kind of filter the feedback, what really helps the design, what are great points, what can you learn from. Like, some people say one thing, and if you would do exactly what they say, it would be bad. But you can understand what's behind what they say, and if you can address that in the game, then it can be good. So that's a big part, just a closeness to the players, and not developing a game 2 years behind closed doors, then releasing it, and suddenly you notice no one enjoys playing this. Like, that wouldn't be great. And so also just quick iteration speed, keeping everything quite simple, trying to move quickly, trying to focus on the core things, trying to keep it very accessible, very swift in a way. But yeah, community-driven development.
Yeah, community-driven definitely helps, because, like you said, after 3 days, you had the game kind of already done. It was just polishing it up, making it beautiful and all that. Now, I guess I could ask you this. Dome Keeper, it started off with one character, with just the scientist. You just break blocks, you bring up materials. How hard was it to develop a new character like the Assessor, or even new domes that give you new protection and weapons? Any tricks or any challenges behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So tricks, not so much. For me, this was a little bit it was really directly inspired by Into the Breach, because they have these squads, and you go in and make basically a run, and you eventually win the run, and you learned how to smash all the monsters. Then you get the second squad, and it feels like it really sucks, because you try to do what you learned with the second one, but it works totally different, and then you have to rethink how you approach combat, and you think much in with the second squad in Into the Breach, you think much more about positions and repositioning enemies compared to the first one, that's a little bit more about damage, and that recontextualizes the whole game. Suddenly you view the same content through different eyes, and this was the same thing I wanted to do with the domes and the keepers. And there, the keepers really are the most complicated thing to make in Dome Keeper, a new thing. It took us quite a while also with the Assessor to arrive at something that is interesting and also feels fun. So we didn't quite manage to get it out on release, but patched it like a month after release. And then it was also interesting to some people, but it felt like 5% of the players enjoyed playing the Assessor.
So I remember when they came out, I was struggling with them.
That was not great, but eventually, I basically digested all the feedback and thought about how can I simplify this one, and then we made a simpler one, and that feels much more playable. It still can, like, if you come from the super simple one to the Assessor, it can still feel like a struggle, but that's basically the Into the Breach level of, okay, I got used to this one, now I play this one, it feels different, it's bad, but then you get used to it and you have to be open to rethink the game a little bit from the perspective of the other people. And then it can be really fun. And a lot of people are like, yeah, I didn't like it at first, but then I got used to it and now I will never go back.
You converted them. So the making the assessor was a lot harder than making all the different domes that you have?
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Because a dome is really only about combat. How do you engage in combat? And with the keeper, you think about three things. You think about mining. How can you destroy blocks? You think about carrying. How can you bring the stuff back? And you think about movement. How does the keeper move through the mine? And ideally, you want to differentiate on all three levels while not breaking how things work with, for example, gadgets. Like you can think of, okay, now you have a keeper that only uses drones for transport. And this is also like where the drones that are now in the game actually came from. But if you only use drones for combat, for carrying resources, what happens to the stuff that, like the big objects that you usually bring back yourself? Suddenly you also need to have that option in a way. And also with mining, you can think about indirect options to mine, but that's also not fun because you want to keep doing something at least.
So yeah, you want to keep the player engaged at all times.
Yeah, then you have to have two modes of mining, and that really complicates it so much. And you see that even with the assessor. It has this pinballs, but also this contact mining. This is an expression of that you don't really want to have this downtime where you cannot do anything. So yeah, absolutely. So just the ways to interact with the world are so plentiful with the keepers that it's much more difficult to make them.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And so you've made a lot of domes in Dome Keeper. It has, I read this on Twitter, it has 320 upgrades total with all the different domes, 35 special upgrades, and 37 tech trees. Did you expect it to become this big after just a three-day game, Jan? Or is this out of your wildest dream, I guess?
I didn't expect it. Although I have to say, like, after we finished the game jam, I thought about, okay, what could the game be expanded like? Because we knew we had something that's fun. And then the only question was, okay, how can we expand this without breaking this? And one of the first things we did was design new domes. And then we had this loadout. And we had, like, from the get-go, like, 4 or 5 domes in our list. Like a harpoon dome or a machine gun dome that never got realized. Only the sword dome actually happened from these ones. Oh, and the artillery. I'm not sure if we had the artillery back then. I think so. But it looks different now.
Yeah, the artillery was really fun.
Yeah. Very juicy. I didn't really expect it, but like I didn't think about the number of upgrades. I knew we wanted to have more domes, for example. I didn't think about having more keepers back then. But I also don't really plan that far ahead.
It just sort of happens naturally.
Yeah. Yeah, I go very step by step, trying not to overthink it, especially if we already know what the game will end up being like.
Do you have any favorite domes for you? I'm always a sword dome with the repellent. That's my classic go-to. Mm-hmm. Do you have any personal favorites?
Yeah, I like playing the most, I think, is sword dome and artillery. Sword dome is really cool because it allows for this skill expression. So if you are really good with that one, it feels really masterful. And you can see that sometimes, like some Twitch streamers play a lot of sword dome. And for example, one player of us, Craig X, he only plays sword dome. And he's really good with it. And if you watch it, it's also really impressive.
Yeah, because he can probably block in every single monster shot while killing every single monster. It's insane, the skill ceiling on that little dome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not for everyone, but if you do it right, it's really satisfying. And laser is very, very simple in a way, right? Intentionally, it's so simple because it's the first dome, and I wanted it to be super obvious in a way. And artillery is also, it feels a little bit similar to a sword dome for me, because you can, for example, launch the projectiles and then you hit a running monster like with this indirect fire because you perfectly timed it.
Yeah, there's
like
a lot of good feeling with that one. That's one of my favorite things with Domekeeper. It's just anyone can find like any type of playstyle that they want and then just perfect it. Like I've looked at the leaderboards and I just see, obviously there is a strongest dome for some people, but there's like a different type of dome everywhere, and it's just really nice that every player can find their thing. And one big thing a lot of people have probably asked for in the past is multiplayer. And I know that you've said you're working on multiplayer and co-op. I feel like you announced it a year and a half ago or something like that. How's that going? Is that still a stressful thing to try to get implemented?
So basically, we had this big content update in summer this year. And this was our last big planned content update. And now the focus really is on multiplayer. And it's a very daunting task in a way. And I've heard some tasks. Recently, I was to GIC, a games industry conference in Poznan, in Poland. And there was a talk about, okay, you want to add multiplayer to your game after releasing? And the guy was like, don't do it.
Don't do it? Why then, not?
Yeah. And then he was okay, no, seriously, don't do it. because it's kind of super hard to add multiplayer to a game that's not designed to have multiplayer on the code level also. I mean, I'm not even speaking about game design, but just the code. Basically, you need to refactor your whole game and rethink all the things you programmed. And what you will end up with is most likely a hacky solution. And for some scenarios, I think you absolutely should not do it. For example, if you have competitive online multiplayer against anonymous people who potentially or could also cheat, there you need server authority and you cannot do client authority. Like, you need a server that says what's true and what's not true and not the player. But yeah, for us, we still started. We actually started, and I'm kind of relaxed about it because I'm not doing it myself. I hired two very smart people, Chris and Austin, who will help us with the multiplayer. And help us is maybe an understatement, because they will implement it for
yeah,
us.
Yeah, you're like, I'm not doing any of this. Just hire these people to do that. You don't want to touch it. That's fair.
Absolutely, and it's true. It's a big challenge. They got experience with it. They are very smart. So I'm very happy to have them.
The success of Domekeeper allows for you to hire people, I imagine, so you don't have to worry about. Do you feel like multiplayer could help bring in a lot of new players or just bring back a lot of people? Because multiplayer in roguelike games is obviously a more popular thing now, but a nice relaxing one is also needed with Domekeeper.
Yeah. It's true, it's a luxury to be able to hire people, but also on the other side, it's like, okay, I could do it myself, and then I would take 2 years to do it. Or I can hire these guys, and they take half a year, or not even that. So it's basically also a decision that economically makes sense. And in terms of popularity, yes, absolutely. So multiplayer has been the number one requested feature since before release, even. Since we ever announced the game. So people are absolutely excited about multiplayer.
I guess I could ask.
I hope it goes well.
I imagine it will go well if you got two professionals making the multiplayer for you. I guess I could ask this. I'm sure this is probably the second most asked question about it besides multiplayer is, would you plan on bringing Domekeeper to consoles like Switch or Xbox and PlayStation?
Yeah. Like, there's nothing specific we can say at the moment, but also consoles have been always requested by the community, and I also see like that it would be a great fit. For example, we also are on Steam Deck, and I think so Domekeeper is also a really good game for Steam Deck. So it's also clear that it would work really well on Switch, for example, because it's very easy to pick up. Put away again.
It must be nice to know the game runs well on Steam Deck, because you're like, all right, this works really well on Steam Deck. The Switch is a lot older hardware, but we'll be able to get it to work on the Switch pretty easily, or the Switch 2 whenever they make that thing.
Yeah, that's actually the right right way to put it, because I recently heard that the Steam Deck is 4 times more powerful than the Switch, and it's not trivial. Like, Domekeeper doesn't look that complex, but you have all these physics simulations. Like, if you have 60 resources in the mine that all are physics simulated, this can be quickly a strain on the CPU. So yeah, definitely it will be a performance challenge, and we have to do a lot of work, I think, to make it. But yeah, we definitely want to do ports, but we can't say anything specific yet.
Yeah, just give it some time. I can understand that 100%. Now, I guess we can go back to co-op a little bit, because I had to ask about the console, because I've always been wondering that too. I'm like, this game is perfect for Switch. Anyways, back in August of 2023, you tweeted about players playing as the fan favorite Drillbert in a co-op simulation as a fun little... And as a joke, you made a controller to play as him. Will this silly feature ever get thrown into the actual game for fun?
I hope so. For me, the idea is to have this, it's called, in the code, I call it a secondary keeper. Like, a keeper you could not play as its own, but if you have another keeper with all the capabilities, you can have the sort of stripped down second keeper. It reminded me a little bit of when you have, for example, a smaller sibling, and you give them an easier role to participate, but they can still join the game, so they can play maybe a thrill. But on the other hand, the first keeper is also so simple that in this scenario, I think, I know that also kids can play with the engineer, for example. My own daughter played engineer runs without monsters when she was 3 years old.
The engineer is a very nice... I think the engineer is a perfect, simple character that gets anybody hooked into the game, like, just like that. They get hooked. I got addicted immediately when I played. But yeah, I had to ask about Drillbert. What about Drillbert merchandise? Because you had plushies back in GamesCon of 2023 and some cool t-shirts. Any Domekeeper merchandise that we should keep our eyes on?
Yeah, that's a good question. So since... I'm not sure if it's related. Oh yeah, it is related. So we had our big update out now, and now there will be a longer pause before we have anything releasable, because multiplayer will be a lot of work, also a very big investment. And if we do consoles, that will also take a lot of time, so there will be a lot of a big gap where nothing happens. So this is actually a good gap to fill with some side things, like, okay, could we do plushies? Could we do t-shirts? So that's definitely something we will look into now. We just talked about it, that this would be good for this period of time. There's nothing coming yet, but I hope we will end up.
Yeah, I mean, everyone seems to love Drillbert, and I would love a little Drillbert plushie as well, because I don't pick Drillbert too much, to be honest, because I see him and I'm just like, oh, I gotta feed him to get him going. I'll just... But he is a cute little dinosaur. Everybody loves him. All right, I got maybe one more thing for Domekeeper before I got a few questions about another thing, which is, I think, the craziest thing in the world. But this one is more so like a, not even like a question, just like a, how do you think of this? According to Steam charts, I've looked at some Steam charts, Domekeeper consistently has 500 to 1,000 players all the time. 24 hours a day, 500 to 1,000 people are playing your game past like 6 months, and it's peaked at almost 7,000 players. How does that feel knowing you have hundreds and thousands of people always playing your game?
Yeah, it's really tough to understand. It feels like, for example, I know that on any given month, we have over 100,000 different people play the game, and this is such a large amount that it's just hard to fathom, like, imagining all these people sit, like, if you had them in one place, how would that look like? And all of them play Domekeeper. That's really crazy to me. And I've also been in really strange situations where I experienced this number a little bit. For example, I was randomly at an airport and there was someone with a laptop sitting there playing DomKeeper.
And you're just like, oh my god, I made that game.
No, yeah, I was just in the background, yeah. And I didn't dare approach him.
Yeah, I'd been like, hey, him. I made that game, you know that? But he's just sitting there looking at him like, oh my god, he's playing my creation.
Yeah. That's a wild moment. Also, just the moment when you tell someone, hey, I work at Bippin Bits and we made this game. Oh yeah, I know that game.
Yeah.
I liked it. Like, even that is surprising. Like, when someone knows your game, because for any game, almost no one knows.
Yeah, because there's so many games released every single day, and you've done a lot of work with, like, itch.io, and that's obviously not, like, the most mainstream thing out there. So having someone just recognize you for the game that you made, that's a surreal feeling, and it's well-deserved because it's one of the best games I've ever played.
Thank you so much. Yeah, for me, the default is still expecting that no one knows the game. So
an indie game dev brain, because it's just, you know, you don't expect the game to blow up. You don't expect it to, you know, gain a massive following and people playing it all the time. But
yeah, and I mean, in my reality, I'm still sitting at home, like typing in the keyboard and don't do much else. It's not like a situation where you have a crowd that
you don't got a paparazzi waiting for you.
No, that for sure, but also not like musicians, for example, they or comedians, they see the halls they fill and they see a change there.
Yeah.
And for us, it's okay, the Steam forum and the Discord fills up, the number goes up, but your lived reality is very similar to what it was before.
You wake up, you go to the PC, you do some coding. You don't get to see the impact that you make, but you're saving a lot of people from, you know, maybe stressful lives, and just like, time to end with a day of DomKeeper.
But it's also the pressure is also up, because I know, like, if I make a big mess,
people are gonna get upset.
Yeah, thousands of people. I can make the day of thousands of people just a bit worse.
Have you had? Well, I guess I could ask that. Have you had like a lot of negative feedback on any updates? Was like the biggest thing maybe when you first made the assessor and people didn't like them, or?
There's constant negative feedback, and that's also something definitely across a certain size. Like if 1,000 people play your game, not everyone will like you, and that's true for every game. So negative feedback is definitely a constant, and for some things it's more concentrated, and there I need to take it more seriously also. And sometimes it's also, for example, with the last update, we changed the loadout from a menu to something that you move in, that you are active in, and it's needed for multiplayer and to accommodate more of the new content. At least I feel like it's needed. And for a lot of people, it's more immersive, and you also learn already the controls a little bit in the loadout. But also, it's different than it was before. And
that's making some people upset.
Yeah. Whenever you change something in the game, it will definitely annoy a lot of people, even if it's better. I'm not saying it's better. It's better in some things. It's worse in other things, for sure. And the stuff people are annoyed about is definitely valid. But also, you have this effect of, okay, it's changed, and I got used to the old one, and changed one is bad. And we had this for the assessor also. Like, we changed the old, very hard-to-use assessor into something much more playable, and not everyone likes the change. So
yeah, it's impossible to please everybody, sadly, but you got to just filter out the negative feedback that doesn't really do anything, and then just focus on what you can do. And now there's one thing that you have done that is, this is not DomKeeper related, but before we end, I want to quickly talk about your next game, which I think it's a genius level of marketing. You know exactly what this is. I think it's genius level of marketing.
I'm not sure which game you mean.
It's the game that called? I cannot pronounce. It's a very German name. But it's PVKK. If you say it, I'll just be so happy. How do you say this game's name?
Yeah, it's just Planetenverteidigungskanonenkommandant.
Yeah, that game is
Straightforward.
was the name of that, like, was that in your head, like, oh, this is genius marketing to make a game with such a absurd name?
No. It was more like at very least initially it so initially it was just a project name that I said, yeah, it's called like that right now, but we will change it. And then we kind of grew attached to the name also. And a lot of people we spoke to, like we got a similar reaction that they laughed about the name. And some people were like, oh yeah, you have to keep that. That's so fun. And a lot
Yeah.
of people also said, like, you definitely have to change that one. That will not work.
I feel like it
So,
works
but
perfectly, to be honest.
yeah. So for us, it was not, okay, this is a genius marketing move to call it like that. It was just, okay, it's funny. It's probably stupid. It's definitely risky, but it's funny. So let's do it.
Yeah, it was
And
just
that's
so it was just
also.
a prototype name, really, to get the project started, and then it just stuck. Oh, that's awesome. I don't know why. I just Can you say it one more time for me?
Planetenverteidigungskanonenkommandant.
Oh my goodness. I want to learn German just so I can say that. People ask me what I'm playing today, I can say that, and they'll just be like, well, what? Okay, so is this like the Okay, no, you say sorry.
The most difficult part for English speaking people, like Planeten is easy, Kanonen easy, Kommandant relatively easy, Verteidigungs, like that's the tough bit for English speaking people.
Can't even I can get commandant. I can do that one for sure. That's the easiest one. Is this I gotta ask, is this like the first major project that hasn't really been part of like a Ludum Dare that you're working on now?
I mean, we've been working on games before before we made Dome that never saw the light of day, and they were never based on, oh, nearly never. There was one game we made based on the game jam because we wanted to practice our truly first game, but we released it without commercial intent. But PBKK, yes, it's the first game we will release that's not based on a game jam. And I think the next two games we release after PBKK will also be based on a game jam. It's my expectation right now. So it's definitely an outlier. And it was also just intended. So we last year, basically one quite exactly 1 year ago, we sat down and we're like, okay, Dome Keeper development is slowly coming to an end. What we know the big game we will do next after Dome Keeper. But before we do that, why don't we make a like 1 month small game in between? And that was PBKK, and that's a year ago now.
One small game, and it's that now.
Yeah, but we very much allow the game to change and the ambition and the scope. We discover a lot of things. So originally, it started as a 2D game. I made the prototype actually for that in 2020. So it's a quite old prototype. I made it in 1 month, the prototype, and never touched it since then. But I showed the to the team, okay, these are the kind of nine concepts I have that we could do. And for PBKK, there was Rafa from our team and I who liked it, and the other ones in the team did not like it. And then we were like, okay, then just Rafa and I will do the small project on the side. And we started it like that. And from there, we really allow it to grow. For example, very quickly came the idea, okay, or even initially, I knew from the 2D prototype that fitting all the controls in the 2D space is tough. So the question was, okay, could we do this in 3D? Rafa is a very capable 3D person, as you can see in the game, I hope. And he built a small 3D prototype, and we were sure, yeah, we can do it in 3D. Now, if we can do it in 3D, can you turn around and can you actually get up from the cockpit and walk around? What would that mean for the game? So and so the 1 month prototype quickly expanded in that way, but it always felt kind of a natural extension or natural conclusion from what we already had. And yeah, that's one thing I wanted to say. All of that, taking the risk with the name and also letting the scope grow like that, it's a very big luxury thanks to the success of Dome Keeper. So we are in a really lucky that.
Yeah, I mean, Domekeeper is great. I guess I could ask, do you have any inspirations for PVKK? Like anything that helped inspired it? Because I saw IGN got to play it maybe like last month, and they said it's kind of like Papers, Please, which is a top tier game.
Yeah. So the reason PVKK exists is foremost about the joy of pressing buttons in real life, like really analog controls, flick switches, the fascination with old machines, complexity of cockpits. That's all really fascinating stuff for me. And as it turns out, a lot of people like pressing
pressing a button.
Yeah, yeah. It's just satisfying to flick a button and to feel the weight in it and to hear the metallic clang. And I feel like probably it's something that's getting more intense now because, for example, also cars are switching over to all these crappy touch screens on the steering wheel, for example, that I really hate.
I don't even have a car, but oh God, that stuff's so annoying. Yeah. Just seeing it, I'm just like, I do not want to drive that.
Yeah. But for inspiration, Papers, Please was definitely the game I mentioned the most to the team initially, because but that was not purely for let's do this fantasy in Papers, Please. It like having a dystopian Eastern Europe style world. That wasn't even it for me. It was Papers, Please was the best example for me where a game doesn't make a ton of, or how can I say it? You have this narrative part in Paper, Please, that grounds your dry daily task in reality, where you get meaning. Why do you check the passports? Okay, because you want to keep your family alive and your aunt from freezing, something like that. So that suddenly becomes a really important thing, but also the kind of decisions that you are put in. So and. When playing it, I felt like it was a small part of the game, and I was expecting it would probably be a small part of the development also, because it's not huge, but maybe this is off. But it felt small, but it elevated the core gameplay a lot. And retrospectively, I thought about Domekeeper also. We always wanted to add some story and the story mode in there, but never got around to doing it. And I think that held the game a little bit back. I didn't want to shove a story in people's faces, keep it accessible, to have you the second screen quality that you don't need to read and focus on the game. But for PVKK, I thought it would really lend itself. And we can elevate this dry cockpit gameplay by this. And also the structure in PVKK, in Papers, Please, that you go on a daily task. You do that, and then you get a summary, and then you are done, and then you have some transition, and you understand what you did this day, and then you go to the next one. Like the structure and the how Papers, Please marries gameplay and narrative. That for me was a big inspiration.
I'm excited for that then, because I played Papers, Please for the first time just a few months ago, and it was just such a simple game. And it's just so fun to play. So, like, hearing that makes me more excited for PVKK, even if I'll never be able to say its name. It'll just be a really good game. And I guess I do have one more question just in total before I let you go and probably get to work on PVKK more. And it's, do you have any questions for me, the average gamer, I guess?
I'm getting questions I was not prepared for.
Yeah.
I wasn't also not prepared for the other ones, but at least the other ones are things I thought about before in the past.
It's okay if you got none.
No, I'm trying to formulate it in the concept. I feel like the games that are most exciting are games in a way that relate to us personally. That like PVKK gets a lot of hype, and I think that's because of many what feels like primitive reasons. Like you just enjoy kind of the fantasy of it and pressing buttons. And I'm wondering if there are other like fantasies or ideas around that people have very dearly somewhere that they think fondly of. that are not present in games or kind of forgotten. I personally have some. For example, around driving car. I won't go into that too deeply, but around driving cars in a very relaxed way. It's not really captured by games, I feel like, but it feels like a very fond memory.
Like a nice, nice relax and drive, not like racing all these people and crashing in this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, that
I'm not sure if you like. I remember one summer where I was driving home. I turned off the radio. I opened the window. I drove slowly and just enjoyed the wind, the warm wind still in the night. That was, and there was something relaxing about that. And I wonder if you have, like,
that type of feeling.
I guess. That could relate to a game. But that's never covered by a game or some kind of desire for something you experienced in the past that's not coming back, but that
you want to be able to experience that type of thing in a game. Oh, that is a really good question. Oh man, that's so hard to think. Like that's so good, because like I can understand 100% what you're saying. Just something nice and relaxing, like you said, pressing buttons or just going for a nice drive. Yeah. Huh. Off the top of my head, I have nothing really.
Yeah, I turned it around now.
Yeah, you really turned that one around. That's a great question. Oh my god! Because usually people just ask, "Oh, what makes a game attractive to you?" And I'm just like, "Oh, I mean, you know, just good gameplay."
Yeah. I'm thinking constantly about new games, and I have many ideas, and I feel like these are the most interesting ones that deeply relate something in one's past. And chances are, if you have a very strong feeling, melancholy, like a certain summer or whatever, that other people have that too.
Yeah, 100%. There's
interesting space.
I think that's a great way to go about making games as well. Instead of, you know, following the trend, oh, everyone's making a deck builder or a live service game, you know? Try to capture the feeling that a lot of people miss. Oh man, that's genius. I'll say that. Almost as genius as having PVKK be the name of a game. I mean, I guess, like you said, just I can relate to the driving one because I haven't driven a car in like 5 years. I can't afford a car where in my current life, but I had one 4 years ago, and I can relate to just driving next to like the beach, because I lived on the coast, driving next to the beach, window down, favorite song on the radio. It's just a relaxed feeling. So I guess I don't want to just steal your answer, but like I can relate to that one. Oh man, now you're making me question, have I done enough in life? I guess hiking could be a good one as well.
Mm-hmm.
A nice relaxing hike, no music, no people even, just you, a path. Oh, a path that you're hopefully know how to follow, supplies, just that type of feeling, walking by a random person that you've never seen before and you never will see them again, and just saying, hey, how you doing? And that's it. I guess that's a nice feeling that I miss that I haven't experienced in a while. And that's that's all I've got. Oh my god, wow, what a best ending question I've gotten so far. All right.
Yeah, that.
All right. Well, everyone that's listening to Interviewing Indies episode 12, big shout out to Renee from Bip and Bits for joining me. Is there any things you want to sell to the people? Any last closing words?
I don't want to sell anything. Just have fun. Appreciate games that try to deliver something interesting to you. So that's it.
I mean, hell yeah. I'll sell the stuff for you. Wishlist PVKK if you like pressing buttons, and if you want to relax in time, you buy Domekeeper and check them out on itch.io.
Thank you.
There you go. And thanks to everyone for listening. Thank you again, Renee, for taking the time, and that's all I got to say.
Yeah, thank you, and time.
Thank you for listening or watching this episode of Interviewing Indies. Big shout out to Renee for taking the time and talking with me about Domekeeper and PVKK. It was absolutely amazing. And if you're an indie dev and you want to get on the show, DM me on one of those social media platforms like Twitter or Blue Sky, or shoot me an email. And again, if you want to listen to the show a few days early and support us, you can subscribe to us on Patreon. Thank you again for listening or watching, and we'll see you next time.